Hello and welcome to Comic Talk Today for Monday, April 30th, 2018. And this is Top of the Pile, the episode of the week where I talk about some of the comics that made the top of my list from last week's New Comic Book Day. And if I sound a little strange today, don't hesitate. My microphone apparently died over the weekend. Well, not the microphone itself, the power supply for the microphone. So I'm using my backup and it's not as good, but that's okay. I'll try to fix as much as I can in post. I'm just glad that I finally got a chance to record this episode, because yesterday was a hot mess. So let's get on to the comics! I've got a ton of books I want to talk about. There's 12 books, as a matter of fact. And I'm going to try to run through them as quickly as I can. The first one up is a Marvel book. And as a matter of fact, this is the only Marvel and DC book that I picked, kind of by choice. There were some really good ones that I read. As a matter of fact, I read the Mira... What's it called? Mira, Queen of Atlantis, I think it is. It's Abnett is writing that. And it's a 6-issue mini, and I haven't been picking it up, but 3rd issue came out last week, and I checked it out, and I really enjoyed it. So I highly recommend, if you're a fan of that side of the world, the Aquaman side of the DC Universe, I recommend you check that out, because it's really, really quite good. I was very surprised. Of course, I read Terrifics. I'm not going to talk about that. I wanted to pick stuff that I hadn't really discussed for this episode of Top of the Pile. And so the first one up is going to be Hunt for Wolverine number 1, of course. And this is something that I teased that I wanted to discuss on the comic predictor episode last Wednesday. And the creative team is Charles Soule, David Marquez, and Rochelle Rosenberg on the first story. There's 2 stories, Secrets and Lives. And the second one is Hunter's Pride. This is Charles Soule, Paolo Sequeira, Walden Wong, and Ruth Renmond. And, of course, this is the return of Wolverine to the Marvel Universe. And it's pretty fitting that Charles Soule would write this, because he's the man responsible for the death of Wolverine back in 2014. So, you know, they always say that comic characters can never stay dead, and this is always true. But I'm kind of glad they put Wolverine to rest for a little while. And I know that we've had Old Man Logan and, you know, X-23 and a bunch of other people take the Wolverine mantle. But I think it'll be nice to have the original Wolverine back, to have Logan back. And this is a couple of stories that kick off the event. And I will call it an event because I think this is pretty important for Marvel itself. And the way that this book is set up, does set it up as an event. The first story, Secrets and Lives, has the Reavers going looking for Wolverine's body. And of course the Reavers are kind of downtrodden. They don't have money. They're apparently terrible mercenaries. But I do love the Reavers, and I'm glad to see them in this book. The art is gorgeous, by the way. And they go and they find Wolverine's grave, and they try to take the body, but of course it's super heavy because it's made of adamantium. That's when the X-Men show up and hilarity ensues. There's a big giant battle. And as it turns out, spoiler alert, are you ready? Here's the spoiler if you haven't read it. Wolverine's body is not inside the adamantium cast that was on this this pedestal that they put him on. So we get to learn a little bit about the story of what happened. After Wolverine was encased in adamantium, he was put in this tomb up on a pedestal. And you know, Storm and Cyclops and Kitty and Colossus were at his gravesite, and they're like, you know, Wolverine needs something better than just to be here. We want to bury him. So Kitty uses her abilities and gets the body out from inside the adamantium cast, and they bury him. And we flash forward to today, and Kitty goes to see him at his grave, and then puts her head down on the ground and realizes that the body's not there. Now we do see Wolverine kind of fighting in some kind of dungeon prison looking thing. So he's definitely back, but nobody knows where he's at, how he got out of there, who's responsible for bringing him back, exactly what happened. All we know is he's not in the cast, and the X-Men want to go out and search for him. So a really cool story. I enjoyed the battle with the Reavers, and I would like to see a whole lot more of them. I loved the Reavers back in the 90s, so nice to see them back in here as well. The second story has Kitty trying to form a team to find Wolverine's body. And she recruits Tony Stark and Daredevil, which is pretty awesome. And Tony is such a douche in this episode, like he normally is. But he's like, thanks for coming to me first. And Kitty's like, well, you weren't first. I went to Daredevil first. And of course, Daredevil is kind of their detective, and so that's why they want somebody with his skills. Because he's an outsider to this whole thing. And he's got some history with Wolverine, and they're going to use it to recruit. And she recruits also Lady Deathstrike and a few others. So, really interesting story. It's a little bit longer than a regular comic, but it's not quite double size. I think it's 30 pages. But overall, I really enjoyed it. I know this whole Hunt for Wolverine event is going to be a little longer than they first announced. I think originally they said it was going to be a 4-issue mini, and now it's like a 4-issue mini, and there's like 6 different one-shots tying in, and I don't know, there's a whole bunch of stuff. I'm not sure how much of all of that I want to read, but I'll definitely be on the lookout for the mini itself. So, Hunt for Wolverine number 1 from Marvel Comics, really, really interesting. I thought it was really well done. And of course, to have Charles Soule bring back the man he killed, I think is a pretty good choice. Even if it's a little MacGuffin-y, I think it worked here. Because after all, this is comics. So I'm going to go ahead and give Hunt for Wolverine number 1 a 4 out of 5. Thoroughly enjoyed it. If you've been itching for some OG Logan, then this might be a good one for you to pick up. From there, I want to move on to Valiant Comics and talk about Shadow Man number 2. Because when Shadow Man number 1 came out, I kind of poo-pooed the book a little bit. I'm not going to lie, I did. I was not entirely impressed with the first issue. This is Andy Diggle writing, Steven Segovia on art, and Ulises Arriola on colors. And I gotta say, this is a 180 for me from the first issue to the second issue. So if for some reason I influenced you to avoid the first one, then you probably want to go ahead and pick that one up again and check out the second issue. I think what Andy Diggle is doing with Shadow Man here is really good if this is the direction that we're going to end up choosing, because this book is heavily, heavily steeped in voodoo mythology and voodoo magic, and I think that's really where the Shadow Man character excels. There's a whole lot of talking about the pantheon of voodoo gods. There's a lot of actual use of voodoo magic. And in really interesting ways, because Elisa, the girl who's helping Jack, his former love interest, she's almost like a Doctor Strange now. It's kind of odd, but really cool in some ways. She even has the circle, the magic circle thing around her hands every time she uses the magic with the runes. So I really dug that bit. We get introduced to the Brethren here, which is a group that has been kind of after Jack's power, after the Shadow Man power. And there's a really heartbreaking scene when we first get introduced to them. The leader is at this lab, and there's a girl that shows up. She's like looking for her parents, and the doctors are like, yeah, your parents are fine. Like, we need to do this because you need to pay your parents' debt. And as it turns out, they're sucking the life out of people to feed this guy. Like, he's just gonna go play golf, and so he wants to be at his best. And so he has these people suck the life out of them and, you know, put it inside of him so he could be at his best. And that was interesting, and this is not something that's entirely out of the norm, to be honest. There's a big thing out in Silicon Valley now where they take young, energetic, young people in top physical shape, and they draw blood from them, and they put that blood inside of, like, these rich tech CEO people. And that's supposed to give them energy and stuff. So it's kind of along that same line, just kicked up another notch, right? Because we have the magical elements and the life force stuff and all that. So Shadow Man number 2, I was extremely pleasantly surprised. I'm glad that whatever issues I had with the first issue were fixed. Of course, there's a couple battles. Elisa and Jack go back and fight the monster in the swamp in the first issue. And as a result, Jack gets grabbed by this monster as he gets tossed back into the dead side. And so it looks like Shadow Man's back in the dead side. Maybe that's how he's going to fight Baron Samedi. But really, really enjoyed it. And the art is fantastic. Steven Segovia, I've always been a fan. So Shadow Man number 2, well worth picking up. I will give this one also a 4 out of 5. The next two I'm going to kind of put together, sort of. I'm going to talk about them in tandem. And this is Cyberforce number 2 and Witchblade number 5. And Cyberforce number 2 is Mark Silvestri, Brian Hill, and Matt Hawkins writing, Attilio Rojo on art. I'm really digging this new incarnation of Cyberforce. I've been a Cyberforce fan for the longest time, since issue 1 back in the 90s. What was it, like 92, 93? And they've done so much world building, so much mythology in this universe of these people and cybernetic enhancements and how that affects the world around them, how these corporations are involved in that. This new iteration is slowly kicking in. In many respects, it reminds me a little bit of the way that Wildstorm is set up, where characters are brought in, but it's not through like, hey, the world's blowing up, let's all band together and try to save it. There's a whole lot of world building, character building, and we're slowly, very slowly being introduced to each character. So the first one we got mostly about Stryker, who's the leader of the team. The second issue deals mostly with Velocity, who's Stryker's daughter, and how this corporation that helped Stryker and saved his life and gave him cybernetic implants is giving the same to Velocity, and how Stryker feels like she needs to be very careful because they're trying to use her like they're going to use him. And she kind of doesn't care because now she's super fast. She's got all these cybernetic enhancements. And we also learn a little bit about Killjoy, who is a really interesting character. And I like the way that she was handled here because she wasn't just a villain, right? And I mean, you can tell she's a bad person, right? She's locked up in this place. They're doing all these experiments. This mystery villain that we have goes and breaks her out, and they start fighting it out. Of course, the villain knows a whole lot about Killjoy, and she tells her, look, I know who you are, I know what your name is, I know why you were put in this place, and she, like, transfers that knowledge to Killjoy, and Killjoy starts crying because she had no idea that this was who she was, right? She's got no memories of her past, and so, as a result, she wants to help this mystery person in whatever she's trying to do, which looks like she's trying to destroy this corporation. Really well done. I love how much character building is in here. This is not your typical Cyberforce, but it is definitely an extension of the stuff that we've seen over the last couple years. The Generation, what was it called? Generation 13, I think it was called. XII, or XII Generation, maybe. Odd title to choose, because it's hard to pronounce, and I'm assuming hard to catalog at a comic book shop, but that did some really interesting stuff with the Cyberforce mythology as well, kicking into the future with these cyborg beings kind of crafting their own kingdoms throughout Earth. This does seem to follow some of that, but of course this is set in the present, and at the end there is definitely an Aphrodite connection because we do see Aphrodite show up. Thoroughly enjoyed Cyberforce. This is definitely a 4 out of 5 as well. And since we're on the Top Cow thing, Witchblade number 5, Caitlin Kittredge, Roberta Ingranata, and Brian Valenza. This is a book that I'm surprised I don't hear more about. Because I think when Witchblade was first introduced, you know, 25 plus years ago, she kind of suffered from the bad girl syndrome, right? At that time in comics, everybody was doing like some kind of bad girl comic. Everybody was doing it, where it's just like the main character is a female who's just a total badass. She's wearing the super skimpy stuff, and she just goes out and kills things or avenges things. And this new volume of Witchblade is the exact opposite of that. In fact, until this issue, I don't think we've ever seen the Witchblade be used, which is really interesting to take that long to introduce the aspect of the book that kind of defines what the book is, right? But I think what the creative team has done here is take Witchblade down to its core and analyze what makes her different from other heroes. And the main character in this book is a detective, just like the original Witchblade was. It's done a little bit differently because she really is after, she's trying to solve this crime, and there's a lot of like police corruption going on. Like one of the cops is smuggling in prostitutes from Russia, and like there's a whole lot of weird things happening here. And I really liked it. because they're trying to solve this murder of one of the cops and how all that's related to everything that's going on. And it really ties in all the characters together. And the main character is very interesting because she's very analytical. She's very much by the book, but she has to work outside of the system in order to figure out what the hell is happening here. So really, really like this one. Witchblade, if you're not reading Witchblade, I highly, highly recommend you pick it up. It's only on issue 5. If you just like a good like crime procedural, it's not quite crime noir, but it's got a lot of those elements, then Witchblade is definitely, definitely interesting. I feel like, based on the way that this issue ends, starting with the next one, we're going to start getting in maybe some of those more mythological sci-fi elements that Witchblade has been known long for. But I highly, highly enjoy this. It's one of my favorite things to read every month when it comes out. And I hadn't talked about it, so I wanted to discuss it on this episode. But that's Witchblade number 5 from Top Cow Comics. And I guess I should bring up Baby Teeth number 10. Of course, Donny Cates and Gary Brown are doing this. I talk about this book, I feel like, every day to somebody. And that's probably true. But this is from Aftershock Comics. And this is kind of the resolution to everything that we've had happen in this book over the last year. We get this all-out attack on the cult's stronghold on this underground island thing that they've built. The baby that is supposedly maybe the savior of the world kind of has these demonic abilities. He and his aunt Heather are trapped in this cell, and the baby uses his powers to portal them into the Red Realms, which is kind of like a different dimension. It's like a hell dimension. So they disappear. His mom, Sadie, is kind of trying to figure out where they're at. His grandma, who's the cult leader, and her demonic bodyguard guy, they're looking for him. A lot of things get resolved in this issue, which I really like. But there's definitely some seeds laid for what happens next. Because the way that this issue ends is a direct callback to the way issue 1 started, in which Sadie is, in issue 1, it was the future, now it's the present, where she's recording everything that happened to her and the baby over the past, right? So everything that we've seen over the previous 10 issues. And she's recording everything for him, so she's got some kind of record. Because now that he is in the Red Realm, she has a new quest, and the quest is for her to try to find her baby in this demonic dimension. And I think it's going to be really interesting. I know I talked to Ronnie and Travis about it on the Aftershock Central podcast. That episode is out today, so you can check that out at nerdlegion.com. But there's so many different ways that Donny Cates can go now. And I would love to see some kind of like epic sci-fi fantasy thing in this hell world with Heather, who is already kind of a badass. But I think placing her in this magical realm would be really interesting. And of course, the baby. And we did get some revelations, too, because one of the previous chosen children and his mom showed up in this issue when Sadie was kind of put in witness protection or whatever. You know, when she and her child had disappeared to the Red Realm, she was in her teens, and of course, he was a newborn. And when we see her here, she's probably in her 40s or 50s, and the kid's like 3. So there's definitely some interesting time dilation effects going on when people go to this magical Red Realm. And I want to see more of that play a part in what this book will become. So Baby Teeth number 10, really, really cool. I like how Donny Cates is melding some of my favorite genres together. And of course, Gary Brown's art is freaking amazing. So 5 out of 5 on Baby Teeth number 10 for me. I guess we'll head on over to Vault. And I had 3 that I wanted to read, and I ended up only reading 2. So the 2 that I read were Cult Classic Return to Whisper number 1 and Songs for the Dead number 1. Deep Roots number 1 came out, and I just ran out of time to read it, so I'm not going to discuss it today. But maybe when I do the tomorrow's episode, I'll just kind of throw my discussion in there for that as well. But Return to Whisper number 1, this is one of the books. This one and Songs for the Dead are one of the books that were supposed to be out the previous week, and Diamond didn't put out. So they released them finally last week, and Vault was super awesome and put those 2 first issues on their website for free. So, I mean, you can go to vaultcomics.com/free-comic-first, I think it is. If that's not it, just go to their website, and you can. There's a link on free comics at the top. But Return to Whisper is, let me see, what's the creative team here? It's Elliot Rahal writing, Felipe Cunha, illustrating, colored by D. Cuniff, and lettered by Taylor Esposito. And this is very much, to me, it's like a mix of Stranger Things, but if the Stranger Things kids grew up, so we see how these things affect how they are as adults. And then there's a little bit of like Tales from the Crypt in here. It's really cool. The design of the whole book looks a whole lot like those horror stories from the 60s, like the EC classics, like Tales from the Crypt or Tales of Horror or things like that, which I've recently read a bunch of that stuff, and I really, really love it. So I'm glad that Elliot Rahal has gone in this direction, and it seems like he's definitely a fan of that as well. But we meet this whole group of kids who are pretty much childhood friends. I'm not going to spoil the story overall, but there's a mystery artifact that these kids want to get. They're not the only ones that want to get it. There's another group, a secret group, that wants to get this artifact as well. And the story intertwines between flashback stories of, you know, establishing their characters, how they're friends, how they're connected, how they learn to find about this artifact, how they're connected to this artifact, and how they decide to go and find the artifact. And then stories from the present, in which they're, I would say, 30-somethings, and how their life has been affected by everything that happened to them as they were searching for this artifact as kids. Now, some of them are really successful. A couple of these people got married to each other, and they used to, you know, love each other, and now they completely hate each other. They want to get divorced. One of their group of friends was killed, and that's why they reunite. Or he committed suicide, supposedly. We'll see. But that's how they reunite, because they want to go to this funeral. The way that the relationships of these characters have evolved over the years is very well represented in this book. And I thought that was really enjoyable, because I love books that are so character-focused, where they can develop so much of who these people are in just a few pages. And in particular, for a first issue, I think Elliot Rahal did an amazing job at doing that, because a lot of comic writers fall short of that. They want to kind of intersperse some of that throughout, you know, like 2, 3, 4 issues. And that works for some books. I don't think it would work for this particular type of story. So I'm super glad that there's so much character development here. And we don't learn everything about everybody, but we do learn a whole lot about the most important people in this group. I would say like 3 or 4 or 5 people. The group's, I don't know, 10 people, I would say. There's a lot of kids here. And there's something that happens at the end that I wasn't expecting in terms of the way these characters react. And I'm sure that's going to play a big deal into things going forward. And really, really amazing. The art is different and not something that I'm generally used to. It's much more cartoony, very simple. But it didn't take away from it in any way whatsoever. I think it works really well in this type of story. So, yeah, thoroughly enjoyed it. This is Cult Classic Return to Whisper number 1. Of course, Whisper is the town where they grew up in. That's why they need to return to it. And I'm going to give this one, again, a 4 out of 5. It was really, really interesting, and I can't wait for the next issue. So again, on the Vault front, Songs for the Dead number 1. This is going to be Andrea Fort and Michael Christopher Heron writing, Sam Beck on art, and letters by End World Design. And this is more of a fantasy story. And I do dig me some fantasy stories. And what I really liked about this is the way that this whole thing plays out is definitely just a setup for what the book will actually be. And I think that's a really interesting choice to make, because we get this weird story. So this is a girl who apparently can talk to the dead, right? She sings to them. That's what's called Songs for the Dead. She can sing to them and bring them back to life. And it's not just people. It can be animals or anything else as well. And so there's this missing kid, and she's like, I'm going to use my abilities to go find them. So she leaves her village, finds the kid dead, brings him back to life. While that happens, the kid wants revenge on the guy that killed him. So they go and look for this guy. They come upon this castle. They get kidnapped in the castle. They get thrown into a dungeon. As it turns out, the guy that runs this group of criminals is very well aware of her abilities to raise the dead and wants to use that for his advantage. And she's like, there's no way I'm going to do it, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, look, I'm going to hurt your friend. And she's like, look, he's not my friend, and he's already dead. And he's like, well, I know you care about him. Otherwise, you wouldn't have raised him from the dead. Well, while all this is going on, there's a lot of really funny moments, and I hope they're meant to be funny, because I thought they were. But like, you know, the kid is dead, so he like takes his arm off and uses that because now he has more space to squeeze it in through the bars in the dungeon. So he like squeezes out the window and like puts his arm back on, and he's very fearless because he's dead. So every time he sees somebody, he like go and try to beat the crap out of him, but he fails every time because he's just a kid. Like, he's not a warrior. So the kid gets killed again. It seems like one of the people who work for this big bad wants to kind of help her because she wants to get out of this whole situation. And so that's pretty much what the rest of the book goes into, how they plot to get, what's the girl's name? Bethany. They plan to get Bethany out of the dungeon and kind of maybe why the motivation for doing that is. And as they're doing that, and like the other girl is like a super badass, right? She's like the guy's right hand. Lord Roland's his name. She's his right hand. And every time they encounter one of their cronies, like, she kills them, and then Bethany brings that person back to life. So they slowly build, like, this army of the dead, which helps them escape. And it was really well done. And at the end, we learn that she's not the only necromancer, right? Which I guess Bethany didn't know this originally. And now, because of this whole event that happened, she wants to learn more about herself. And so at the end of the book, we see that they're going to go on a journey through this magical, I guess, medieval land. It's definitely, there's no technology here whatsoever. And she's going to find this group of necromancers, so hopefully she'll learn a little bit about herself. But really well crafted, really interesting story. And I can't wait to read the second issue, because I think that's really when the story's going to kick in and kind of tell me what this book is about. Right now, the first issue was more of an introduction, I would say. But this is another 4 out of 5 for me. It's fantastic, and Bolt is just knocking it out of the park. So I'm going to get to the last three books. Of these three, I wasn't surprised that I loved one, but the other two just kind of came out of nowhere for me. And the first one I want to talk about is a Dark Horse comic. I don't know if I've... Well, maybe I have. Oh, yeah, I've talked about the Lemire books. Those are Dark Horse. But Aliens Dust to Dust, number one. This is written and illustrated by Gabriel Hardman, who's freaking amazing. Letters by Michael Heisler and colors by Rain Barreto. Of course, this is an Aliens franchise story. Dark Horse has had the license for that. We'll see. I don't know if they're still going to have it or for how long they're going to have it. But I think the Dark Horse Alien books are generally really interesting. The Predator ones as well. I love both of those properties. I've seen all the movies in those franchises like a gazillion times each. I really, really love them. As a matter of fact, I think this last week was Aliens Day, if I'm not mistaken. So maybe that's why they released this book. Anyways, this is, of course, kind of a typical alien story. We're in this colony in space, and there's some kind of attack. We don't know what it is. Of course, as alien fans, we do know what it is, but if you never watched an Aliens film or read an Aliens comic, then maybe you don't know. And you hear sirens, there's explosions going on. This is happening at night, so the kid wakes up, and he's like, "Mom, where are you?" And he looks over, and the mom's got a face hugger on her face. Of course, that's a little spider-looking alien that attaches to people's faces and kind of lays the egg. The kid like tries and wakes up the mom. He knocks the face hugger off, and so the mom wakes up, and they're like, "We got to get the hell out of here. Let's pack a bag and go." And that's one thing I really liked about this issue, is that it's like nonstop action from the beginning to end. The Alien franchise does that really well. You've got those moments where it's like action, 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 action. And then you have like slow moments where you're like, well, what's going on? There's nothing around. And then you get the scare, you know? So, yeah, really well done. This is LV-871, which I was trying to find. Well, I'm not going to lie. I didn't try to find. But I know in one of the Alien films, when they go to that colony, that is also an LV colony. But the number was much lower. So I'm assuming this is maybe slightly in the future. And maybe these people hadn't seen aliens in a while, and that's why they weren't kind of prepared for this whole thing. So you would think, after everything that we've seen in the Alien films, like, every colony in the universe would have some kind of early warning system or deterrence, or, like, they may have figured out some kind of, like, pill that they could take where the facehuggers don't stick. I don't know. This is a really emotional story. The mom and the son, dealing with a whole lot. And of course, as the story progresses, we see the mom kind of getting sick or dizzy. I know, I'm like, oh my God, like there's definitely an alien inside her. And when is this going to happen? But she keeps going, does whatever she can to try to get her son out. She does come upon this group that's trying to escape as well. And right before that, she goes to get attacked, and the alien kind of stops and just walks off because she's infected. And of course, they're not going to attack somebody that's infected because they're trying to protect their brood. They keep going. There's like destruction everywhere. Stuff's blowing up. Aliens are eating people and killing people. And they finally get to the escape ship. And once they get in there, you can imagine an alien pops out of her chest. Really well done, though. There's a lot of really powerful emotional moments in this. And again, it's nonstop action from beginning to end. If you're a fan of this franchise, or you just love really like action-packed stories, then Aliens Dust to Dust is a really great place to be. This is a 5 out of 5 for me. I was so impressed and so pleasantly surprised. Next up on the list is Hillbilly, number 9. This is from Albatross Comics. I love Hillbilly. If you've never heard of it, go find this somewhere. I know Eric Powell shows up to a bunch of conventions. Hillbilly is just something else. And issue 8, it came out in like 2007. It's been like a year, okay? It's been at least a year since the last issue of this came out. And I'm not sure like what the deal is, if there's some kind of personal reasons or what it is, but Hillbilly, ever since I found this, I don't know, a year and a half, 2 years ago, I've been really enjoying it. I try to pick it up whenever I can. This just brings me right back to the story. So if for anybody that doesn't know, Hillbilly is about this witch hunter, and pretty much when he was a kid, he came upon this witch, and he started to help her, but then she betrayed him, and then he got this weapon from the devil, and the weapon is a witch killer, and it looks kind of like a giant meat cleaver, and he's a total badass with it. This takes place in like the Appalachian Mountains, so he's just kind of traveling through there and killing witches and weird things that live in the woods. And throughout the first 8 issues, we also get to meet this kid who he saves from the witches. And so issue 9 obviously takes place much later in our story, or at least a few years later in the story, where James has become an adult. We finally kind of learn what his name means. He's James the Stone Turner. And as it turns out, he is from a long line of stone turners, going back to, it looked like maybe Vikings, but I don't know, it was kind of ethnically ambiguous type of people. But pretty much he has the ability to control stones, and that plays an important part towards the end. But he's trying to kind of embrace his background, but he really doesn't know a whole lot about it, so he wants to learn more. We've got the Hillbilly, who's also wandering through the woods, and the Hillbilly comes up upon Hansel and Gretel, which I think they're named, it's Hansel and Gretel here, but it's obviously Hansel and Gretel, because when we learn their backstory, we learn that they were kids who went to a witch's house, and it looked like just a house made of gingerbread and candy. But it was just an illusion by this witch. And as they were eating the candy, it was really just like pure evil that they were eating. And they turn into these weird, I don't know, trollish looking monsters. And they're gigantic, gigantic. Of course, they are out to serve their witch, the witch that turned them. And they go and attack the Hillbilly. And Hillbilly's kind of getting his butt kicked. As all this is happening, we see James show up to this tree. And the tree is like the oldest tree in the area, and the tree starts talking to James and tells him his whole background story, which is beautifully illustrated. I think the writing in Hillbilly is really well done. There's a lot of play and mixing of mythology and like fairy tale elements into the narrative of the book itself. Most of it is told through narration. There is some dialogue, but there's a lot of narration as well. In particular in this issue, because we're learning a lot of backstories, right? We learn about the trolls, we learn about James and all that stuff. But the art itself is just really amazing. The story, when it's in the present, it's, I don't know if it's watercolored or maybe with like charcoal pens or pencils. I don't know what the charcoal things are called. But it's got that vibe, and it's all gray tones and sepia. And then once you get, whenever you get flashback scenes, it's the same kind of thing, right? Like gray tones and sepias, but it's kind of scratchy at the same time, but extremely polished. It's hard for me to describe it. I think the best way to get a feel for it is to go buy an issue of Hillbilly. And you can definitely get the early ones in trade. So, really interesting though, when James learns about himself, he opens up to what he truly is. The stone that he's carrying kind of lights up, and I guess that's when he embraces things. Going back to the Hillbilly, they're kicking his butt. They take his cleaver, throw it into the lake so that he can't kill the trolls or any more witches. And that's when James shows up and just like starts pummeling these guys with stones. He lifts Hillbilly's cleaver out of from the lake on this one stone. And he looks like a total badass when they show him. He's like floating on a rock. Super, super awesome. Of course, Hilly gets his cleaver back. We can assume kills the trolls, although we don't really see him. One of the little demon guys that's with the trolls runs off and goes to tell the witches that the Hillbilly's back. And so now we go and cut to the witches at the end. And the witches are like, look, we need to unite together, form a new coven that will steep the hills in blood. And so it seems like there's going to be some kind of war between the Hillbilly and a whole ton of witches, as it seems. Hillbilly number 9, though. Man, oh man, oh man, do I love this book. This is for sure 5 out of 5 for me. I can't wait till the next one, and I hope it's back on a regular schedule. The final book that I wanted to discuss today is, this is not a joke, Ice Cream Man! Ice Cream Man number 4 from Image Comics. This is written by W. Maxwell Prince, art by Martin Morazzo, colors by Chris O'Halloran, and letters by good old Neon. Good old Neon! Let me preface by saying, so this doesn't end up not making any sense as I discuss. In many ways, Ice Cream Man is an anthology book. Okay, so when I start explaining the story, don't expect to need to know anything about this. I don't know if this will be the thing going forward, but with every issue of Ice Cream Man, and I read all 4 issues this past week because I was like, I'm just going to try this Ice Cream Man and see what it's about. I didn't want to read it because of the title. I'm like, I don't want to read a comic about an ice cream man. But I picked it up, really dug number 4. I went back, I picked up issues 1, 2, and 3 as well. And each story is a thing unto itself. Okay, they're like little vignettes. Each issue is a different vignette, with the central connection being the Ice Cream Man. Who the Ice Cream Man is, we really don't know. What his abilities are, we really don't know. All we know is somehow he is connected to all of these issues, all of these stories. Based on what happens at the end of this 4th issue, my assumption is we're going to start learning a little bit more about what the connection is, but we'll get there in a second. So, with that out of the way, you can pick up Ice Cream Man number 4 and not have to read anything else previous. You can pick up at any issue whatsoever and not have to worry about continuity or anything like that, okay? They're all single vignettes. And I think of the 4, this one was both the least disturbing and the most disturbing at the same time. It is definitely one of the more emotional stories. And this has to do with this guy who's married to this lady who's pregnant, and he's going to go to a funeral. This takes place, there's Polaroids, so I'm assuming maybe in the 80s, or maybe even 90s. Anyways, he's going to be attending this funeral for this guy that died, and the guy's been estranged from his dad for many, many years, and the dad shows up as well. I'm not going to go in-depth at it, because I think it'll spoil a lot of things, but this is very much a personal book. It's extremely emotional. Because we learned the reason why the guy that's dead and his dad hadn't been talking for so many years. You know, like the dad thought that there was more to life than just family. And so he went and joined a cult, and he's just like banging chicks like rabbits because that's part of the cult thing. They're doing drugs all the time. And so, of course, he lost connection with his kid. And on the other side, we have the other guy kind of wanting to go in the same path because his wife is married, or you know, he's married to his wife. They've got a kid on the way, but like he doesn't want a kid. He was thinking about filing for divorce. And so they have a long discussion, conversation about, you know, family, what it means, what it doesn't mean, how it changes people, how it shouldn't change people, and, you know, the importance of it. And I thought that was really well done. And it was both tragic and emotional, you know, because it would suck, like, if for whatever reason I disappeared and, you know, I ended up finding that my kid died. Like, first of all, that would be heartbreaking to have a child die at any age, right? Like, this guy's a grown man. He's probably in his 50s or 60s. The kid had to be in his 20s or 30s. But at any age, to have a parent lose a child is very tragic. But the circumstances in which all this happens, I think, makes it extra tragic. But we do learn that maybe the guy wasn't the best person, because there's a couple pages towards the end where he's maybe in hell, but it's not really hell, because it's all candy, because the ice cream man is kind of there torturing this guy. Well, not directly, but indirectly. He's in a dungeon, he gets, like, I don't know, like, air pumped into him, so he, like, gets super puffy, and then, like, they take the air out of him. He's, like, in this group, and there's a bunch of trumpets being sounded at him. I don't know. There's a whole lot of weird stuff. And this weird ice cream monster pops in. And, yeah, who knows? There's a lot of weird stuff in this one. I'm sure I could go and reread a few times and go more in-depth into what this is. But it seems pretty obvious to me that the guy was not the best person, and so he is definitely in hell. And that goes in direct contradiction to what his dad says. Because after all this talking about family and emotions and things, they're like, well, why don't you just hug him one last time? So they go to the cemetery and bring up the casket and take the body out of it so that the dad can hug him one more time, because he hadn't seen him in years. And he just wants to hug his kid, but now he can't because he's dead. So they pulled the dead body out so he can hug the kid. And he's like, I hope he's in a good place. And of course, we know that he's not in a good place. But at least, you know, for him personally, he's getting some kind of closure. And, you know, he apologizes to his son. You know, says, I'm sorry that I messed up. I have it all twisted. It was nice. Especially those last few pages were extremely emotional. But this is when things get really weird. So we finally see the ice cream man here at the end. I mean, we kind of see him through the story, but I don't want to spoil it. We do see him at the end in his ice cream truck, and he's giving this girl ice cream cone. And this mysterious stranger in a black hat shows up, and he's like, Almighty, you're still at this shit, huh? And the guy's name is Caleb, apparently. And Caleb is not very pleased with what Almighty is doing. So it was cool to have finally a name for the ice cream man. But who this mysterious stranger is, we don't know yet. It looks like maybe these are maybe two gods. Maybe even like God and the devil. And they're just kind of playing around with the world. I look forward to see how this goes on in the next issue. But Ice Cream Man is for sure my surprise pick. And it's really, really fantastic. Ice Cream Man number 4 from Image Comics is going to be 5 out of 5. Surprise. And I think that's going to wrap it up. Thanks for listening to this Comic Talk Today episode of Top of the Pile. I guess the other way around, huh? Anyway, it doesn't matter. If you want to get in touch with me, @GeekVine is the best place on Twitter. You can, of course, send me an email, comictalktoday@gmail.com. And I did hand out a couple of codes for Monica's book last week, The Friendship Paradox. I have 2 codes left. So if you still want that book, get in touch with me. I will happily send you one for free. And of course, if any of the books that I discussed on this episode are enticing to you, the first person who tells me they would like to check this one out, I'm assuming Ice Cream Man is going to be popular, just FYI. First person to send me a comment and tell me they want to pick up one of these books and why, I will send you a Comixology code to get it for free. So thanks for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with a brand new episode. This week, so I went to see Infinity War this past weekend. I'm not going to talk about it today, so don't worry. But I took my girls to see it with me. So at the end of the week, for the first time ever, my oldest daughter, she's 14, she will be joining the podcast, and we're going to be discussing Infinity War and how the experience was different for her, because she's not a big comic reader. So I think it'll be interesting. I hope you tune in for that. That'll probably be out on Friday. This week's guest on Therapy Thursday is BJ Mendelson, who does a comic called Vengeance Nevada, who has an awesome book called Social Media is Bullshit, and he's going to be my guest this week. I'm going to be talking to him about a bunch of different things. Thanks for listening. Catch you Wednesday.